He was Arthur Evans, an Englishman. I'll take you more calls for a few minutes. Well, let's save that a minute. Let me finish putting poor old Vice in the hole in the ground he belongs. From the book, The Stairway to Heaven, by Zachariah Sitkin. Now, he has an interesting theory about visitors from outer space. And his theories about visitors from outer space are entertaining, but not the primary interest I have in this book. In order to promulgate his theory, the importance of the pyramid and its connections to certain other sacred places require that the pyramid not be built by Khufu. Lights, please. Now, Khufu is his Egyptian name. Cheops is the name the Greeks gave him. So Khufu and Cheops are the same animals. Got that? You got to follow these names around a lot. As you study ancient history and mythology and legends and try to determine, is there a factual basis for any of these legends? People used to say Homer's Troy and the entire war stories that he wrote about between Greece and Troy were all fiction. Until Schliemann, or Schliemann, the German archaeologist who believed that Homer's writings had a basis in fact, began to use Homer on that assumption and found Troy. He used it to dig at a place that everyone else hadn't dug, found Troy. Suddenly, Homer got a new look. Now, myths and legends exist with certain common traits in about every culture. One way to look at it is that the Bible was written by drawing from these legends, no better nor worse, in its version. Another way to look at it is that there was a common heritage, a reservoir in the memory pool of the descendants of Adam, that outside the elective controls of God ran free, and thus were distorted and exaggerated. And neither the biblical record nor the myths in other cultures necessarily drew upon each other, but rather represent a branch of growth from a common source, one in a controlled environment under God's direction, through the priestly line up to Noah, and through Abram after the flood, and thus represents the accurate rendition of the important points that God selectively wanted to emphasize, whereas those with a common memory pool were free to exaggerate without God's selective control in other cultures. Now, God will develop one line to a certain point and tell us they had kids and just leaves them there like a limb that disappears into a cloud. And he'll pick up the line, which is the one that is important to him, and carry it all the way to Jesus. Now, the Bible doesn't spend too much with Ham and his descendants, for example, except as they illustrate his ability to carry out what he says, or when those descendants of Ham encounter the descendants of Shem and are illustrative of God's control on history. Outside of that selective control that God would exert in the record, they're free to develop in any kind of imaginative stream they want. God doesn't do a lot with the descendants of Nimrod, which carry forward the cursed line of Ham, because Nimrod was the son of Cush. Now, with the development of the science of archaeology, the breaking of ancient languages, archaeology begins to reveal historic substance to many of the legends and myths that have developed outside of the selected line that the Bible is concerned about. And you'll find someone like Velikovsky that decides to take the El Armana tablets and attempt to reconcile the archaeological story revealed therein from the Egyptian side of the same period with the same events and happenings that are biblically recorded in the Exodus. It's valuable because he ends up at a time when it was considered that the Exodus took place in the 12th century. He ends up dating the Exodus within 7 years of the date that the pyramid nailed down, which is in the 15th century. And more archaeology with these surrounding things confirms the true record, which God protected through a chosen people that were chosen precisely to be his oracle, in spite of their tendency to turn their chosenness into something of privilege. They were chosen with a responsibility to be his oracle, his instrument of revelation and preservation of the history that's most important. I did a little dating this afternoon, 11th chapter of Genesis. You know, we have B.C. and A.D. So what's this got to do with vice? Nothing. I'll get to vice in a minute. These are the generations of Shem. 10th verse, 11th chapter of Genesis. Shem lived 100 years. He was 100 years old and begat Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. So Arphaxad was born in AF 2. After the flood, 2. Correct?
Yes, sir.
Now Arphaxad lived 530 years and begat Selah. So Selah was born AF 37, if these records are correct. And if you assume the Bible is true, do you? More or less? If you assume the Bible is true, maybe I should say, if one assumes the Bible is true, Noah lived, I'm looking for the passage, I think it was 350 years after the flood. And Shem, verse 11 of the 11th chapter, said he lived after he begat Arphaxad 500 years. Is that what it says in 11th verse?
Yes, sir.
That means when he died, it was 502 AF. Is that correct? 28th verse of the 9th chapter. Noah lived after the flood 350 years. AF 350. Now, if you keep going, you find Selah lived 30 years and begat Eber. That takes us to AF 67. I could be a little bit wrong, but let's do it quickly. In verse 16 of the 11th chapter, Eber lived 430 years and begat Peleg. That's AF 101. Peleg was born. Now Peleg lived 30 years and begat Reu. AF 131. And Reu lived 230 years and begat Serug, AF 163. And Serug lived 30 years and begat Nahor. So Nahor was born 193 years after the flood, if these records are correct. And Nahor lived 920 years and begat Terah. So Terah, the father of Abraham, was born 222 years after the flood. And then it's sort of confusing about Terah. It says Terah lived 70 years and begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. All the same year or within the 70 years? So you got a little play there. Now that looks to me like that Noah still had, when Abram was built, assuming it was in the 70th year of Terah. He might have been born sooner. Noah still had 77 years to live. Correct? Because Noah lived 350 years. And Shem had 229 years to live. That's longer than the United States has existed. But Shem was still going to be playing around. Now, Shem had all the knowledge. Of having lived 98 years before the flood, and Noah had more, and neither Ham nor Japheth were born during the flood. So here are Noah and his sons with an antediluvian history. And Shem, the one that's blessed, thus to inherit the function of the priestly line that had gone from Seth through Methuselah to Noah to Shem, had 502 years after the flood. We say, I don't believe that stuff. Well, I don't care. I find it hard to believe, too. However, if there was a flood, there's a next question, was it worldwide? And people say, well, I don't believe it was. Well, I don't care. I find it hard to believe, too. But the biblical description of the flood is not only the fountains of the deep opening up, but it could rain 40 days and it wouldn't flood the earth. There was a source of water much greater than rain as we know it. And it had never rained prior to the flood. I didn't even know what it was. So obviously the earth was different. Now you who just joined me, primarily Hartford, I'm in the middle of something. Prior to the flood, if it existed, if the flood occurred, and if the Bible's correct, it didn't rain on the earth. Now, it was a scholar over here in Pasadena, more than any other person who pioneered the research into the canopy theory, that this earth was covered with a canopy, creating a kind of a hothouse effect, which said canopy opened near the pole, which is why the most ancient of civilizations looked for heaven in the north, because that was the way out. Does that make sense? Like, as the earth revolved, there was a canopy, and the openings were at the pole. Now, this is not a night to study the canopy, which is a very intriguing theory. But it would make sense of no rain, a widespread subtropical type climate. And if that canopy broke and water spilled from the skies with that kind of volume, as well as the fountains of the deep, then the flood makes a little more sense. Now, Josephus says in his writings, and I've said this many times, that prior to the flood, the descendants of Seth had a warning of a Holocaust to come. And that's pretty clear. Enoch preached that. And they preserved a kind of time capsule in two places, one at Mesopotamia and the other in Egypt. The one in Mesopotamia of brick, the other in Egypt of stone. And one theory is that the pyramid that Josephus says is the one in Egypt, still standing in his day, whereas the one in Mesopotamia made of brick was destroyed. The pyramid, then, it is claimed, might be the one that preserved the time capsule with knowledge revealed by God to the priestly line prior to the flood. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
If that were not the case and Josephus was wrong, there's still some pretty smart cats. Older than any of you who climbed out of that boat following the flood. Now, you ain't ever going to find the Ark on Ararat. Ararat simply means highest mountain. Now, every ancient culture preserves the legends of the gods coming down from the mountain. If you're in Greece, Mount Olympus becomes the mountain. If you're in the Middle East, Ararat becomes the mountain. Sinai even has a holy mountain. The Bible records that they moved from the east and came to the plain of Shinar. You don't go east from Mount Ararat and come to the plain of Shinar. You're going to end up in the Mediterranean Ocean if you do. Now, we make void the Word of God by our traditions. Now, if there was a canopy before the flood, there are lots of ways to explain longevity of life among the patriarchs, particularly the antediluvian ones. Henry Drummond has defined life as capacity to relate to one's environment. And we now know in modern science we make people live with various parts of their body. Man was cut off from the source of life. And he began to die at that moment. He didn't drop dead instantly. Most likely, that separation from God produced a gradual deterioration that cut the lifespan. Science is now recognizing that man's body is basically designed to be immortal. And modern science is extending the lifespan as we approach the knowledge that resides in God. Maybe that's the reason. But another explanation is, what effect do the sun's rays have on aging? And did the canopy provide a protection that was removed after the flood? In any event, those are all other subjects. Shem and Japheth and Ham and Noah lived a while. And you know how smart you would be if you right now, how old are you? If you could look forward to another 700 years, well, of course, if you were TV evangelist, that'd be 7 years of moronic expression. But as smart as you are, Someone has said it's a shame that youth has to be wasted on youth. I'm a lot smarter now than I was when I came here some years ago. Give me another 20 years and I might begin to know something. Do you know how smart I'd be if I could live 900 years or 500 years? Now, doesn't it puzzle you a little bit the way Noah and Shem and Japheth and Ham just sort of disappeared? Well, there's a few 100-year-old, 120-year-old. Moses lived 120. But that's just a drop in the bucket. Look what Moses accomplished. He only lived 120. What do you think he could have done if he'd lived 900? I mean, these guys are really something. Now, I don't care whether you believe it or not. Let's just assume it's true for a minute or two. Where did these poor old cats go? Now, there's a Baptist over here at a Baptist college in Southern California that's written the book, The Origin of the Nations. Now, his theory is that just as God gave a Pentecost to build the church, a supernatural endowment to the apostles that made happen the impossible commission of Christ. I mean, here's Christ looking at this little old bunch saying, they were going to shake the world. A supernatural endowment at Pentecost of power enabled them to turn the world upside down. This Baptist here in Southern California, at a Baptist Bible college, no less, in his book, The Origin of the Nations, believes that God gave Noah and Shem and Japheth and Ham a supernatural endowment to repopulate the earth. Now, you walk down that hill with just four women and four men and have the task of populating this whole earth, you need something supernatural. How do you like to be the four woman with the, women with that job? I think this is very fascinating that a Baptist come up with this theory. And of all the things on earth, this Baptist cautions us not to project onto these people our moral system. The Baptist. I didn't write the book. It's a Baptist professor at a Baptist college here in Southern California. Don't go stamping your rules of morality on these eight people. They have a job to do. Hashem lived 502 years. Are you going to repopulate the earth with one poor woman? It's a Baptist arguing. And he draws much of his research from the archaeological find of the Celtic cauldron, which shows these original eight, the patriarchs and the matriarchs of the perpetuation of the Adamic race. Shows Noah, a Mongolian, the white matriarch was his wife. Ham, Shem, and Japheth being the product of that union. Ham being married to the black matriarch. And Shem. And Japheth being married to the red and yellow matriarchs, respectively. And this Baptist, no less, postulates that Noah got bored with the white matriarch, or vice versa. And there are daughter-in-laws available. And when you live another 350 years, nieces and grandnieces and granddaughters, a Baptist. And they had divine unction. A supernatural potency. A Baptist. I got to keep saying, in case you tune in late, this didn't come out of my liberal mouth. Go find that book in my car, Origin of the Nations. And they moved around and set up camps or centers of influence. These mortals who came down from the mountain and subsequently in certain legendary sources were deified. Now Ham, through Cush, had the curse placed on him. And his son, Cush's son, was Nimrod. I'm boring you. Nimrod was the great rebel. And Cush's father started the rebellion, and Nimrod finished it. And Cush's father started Babylon, and Nimrod finished it. And one of the errors we talked about in Genesis is a translation error. They give a proper name meaning to Asher when it should have the verb meaning. When Nimrod became strong, he founded other cities, Asher not being a city, but a description of his strength, finally founding Nineveh. And Nimrod became a great power. The apocryphal books suggest that the garments that God created for Adam and Eve from the animals he slew, to create a covering for them, which had a typical meaning, had a power to the holder or bearer of those garments over animals, which enabled Adam and Eve to survive at the outset. That these garments came through the priestly line into the possession of Noah, which gave to him the power to command and bring the animals and control them both into the ark and through the flood in the ark. Maybe what Ham did was more than peep in on his father. The apocryphal books say he stole those garments. They became the possession of Cush, and then to Nimrod, giving Nimrod his power over the animals, enabling him to deliver the people from the fear of the animals. This is in the apocryphal books. And letting him be known as the great hunter and the one who delivered the people from the fear of animals, which gave him his leadership role and enabled him to set up his kingdom. He moved east and conquered Egypt, or rather west, and conquered Egypt all the way to Libya. Hyslop, Alexander Hyslop, in his book, The Two Babylons, has traced the etymological roots of the ancient Bible name of Egypt to a descriptive term, the builder of dams or the driver back of the water, and all ancient maps and statements about early Egypt have lower Egypt, a marshland. And Hyslop's theory is that Ham became the great leader of Egypt because he was the one who drove the waters back and, in essence, raised the land of Lower Egypt from the sea. And the action he did became another one of his names. And Egypt to this day carries that name among its names. You find it, Mike? Origin of the Nations, John Pilkey. John Pilkey. Gundestrup Cauldron in the National Museum in Copenhagen. Around this cauldron are the faces of the matriarchs and the patriarchs, and none other than the Celts, considered to be barbarians, have produced perhaps the greatest archaeological find of history. Give me a picture. Come on. J.D., when you take this picture, go change places with Mike. Okay, that's enough. I'll go change places with Mike. Lay your camera down here and get Mike over here. About the author, John D. Pilkey, at the time of this book, was associate professor of English at Los Angeles Baptist College in Newhall, California. Completed a THM, Master's in Theology, with Dallas Theological Seminary. He's the one. It says, we have found that the female survivors of the flood were quite powerful, and that a certain fraction of the names in Genesis 10 refer to females on the personal level. Lehab, Naphta, Pathros, and Kaphtor in the Mizraim section, Sin, Arvad, Zemer, and Hamath in the Canaanite section, and Almadad, Jira, Uzal, Sheba, Ophir, Havilah, and Jobab in the Joktanite section. The maternal factor was supremely important because of Noah's task of preserving a plenitude of racial types from the antediluvian world. God wanted this plenitude of racial types from the antediluvian world, is his thesis, passed on. Curiously, he says, the name Havilah appears twice in Genesis 10, once in the Cushite section, again in the Joktanite section. The reason for this is that the two persons named in these sections were genetic bearers of the racial type which had inhabited the antediluvian land of Havilah in Genesis 2:11. In dealing with early... Is this boring to you? In dealing with early Genesis, genetics must be treated as a metaphysical phenomenon. Adam and Eve were genetically unique for four reasons. One, they had no human ancestry. Two, they possessed the genetic potential to generate all the racial types of mankind. Three, their offspring could bear children only through various degrees of incest. And four, their offspring enjoyed high longevities unknown to modern man. A Baptist is saying all this, friend. I think I better just leave that alone until you're ready for it. Ham went down to Egypt. Now in Babylon, Nimrod and his wife Semiramis were the producers of the alternate, competitive religion that has spread through the world that was Satan's counterfeit for Christianity. He heard the prophecy in Genesis 3, Satan did, that is, that the seed of the woman would bruise the head of the serpent. He was present in the councils of heaven that Romans 8 refers to. When the lamb slain from the foundation of the world, God's fail-safe plan was promulgated. He had access to the councils of heaven when the sons of God gathered. He was there to accuse Job. He's still there. Will be till Michael, in the last days of the tribulation, casts him out of the heavenlies. Until that permission is given, even Michael, the archangel, when they wrestled over the body of Moses, dared not rebuke Satan. And he set up a counterfeit plan. The cursed descendants of Cush became his tools, Nimrod and Semiramis. And to contra that was the blessed line through Shem. Again, the apocryphal books have it that when Abram was about to be born, a prophecy came to Nimrod, who was the king at the time, and Semiramis, prophesying that the son of Terah would become the overthrower of Nimrod, and what Abram became, God's instrument of faith and deliverance. Nimrod did something that is repeated throughout Scripture, what the Pharaoh did, what Herod did. He sought to kill all the babies. He demanded that Terah kill his son, and Terah sent him away, and his boyhood was with Noah and Shem. And Shem, the last of the priestly line, was the teacher of Abram. So he didn't get his faith by accident down in Ur, and there's a reason why he was the only person who had faith. Shem taught him. Shem was around. Where was Noah? Let's leave Noah for a minute. You don't care? Now, Ham's down doing his deal down in Egypt. And the very first of the shepherd kings, of whom subsequent shepherd kings are descendants, Shem came. And you meet Ham in Egypt. Through his descendants. And Shem came to Egypt to try to bring in the true faith and to clean up the idolatry that was spawned through Ham and his descendants. Returns to Palestine and builds Jerusalem. And what you have in Melchizedek is not a Christophany where Christ is appearing in the Old Testament. You have none other than Shem, the teacher of Abram, to whom Abram will pay his tithes when he encounters him again at Jerusalem. Where is Noah? Now put some names down. Alexander Hislop has traced the connections between these various names. Cush, you're going to encounter in Babylonian literature all the way to Greece, is none other than Belus, Bel, Hermes, which simply means son of Ham, which is what Cush was, Mercury, Baal, Merodach, Chaos, Janus, Hephaestos, Vulcan. In various cultures, they're all Cush, according to Hislop. And he lays a good case down. Son of Cush is Nimrod. Nimrod will be encountered under the name of Ninus, or Ninus, Cronus, Saturn, Bacchus, King of the Cyclops, also called Baal or Bel on occasions, as Nimrod and Tammuz tend to interchange. Cones in Egypt, the Latin consuls, and more importantly, in Egyptian religion, Nimrod is encountered as Osiris. He's also called the Horned One, the god of fortifications, Zernibogus, which breaks down to Zernibogus, which means seed of Cush, or Geber the Mighty One. Sometimes he's referred to as the Horned Bull. Now I just joined a bunch more people, and I'm in the middle of something, so I can't be interrupted. Now, all of these various names represent the same personage in a different cultural frame, as Semiramis becomes Ashtoreth and Ishtar and Diana. You encounter Semiramis as Diana at Ephesus. Am I boring you? In Babylon, Tammuz is the son of Nimrod. In Egypt, Horus is the son of Osiris, Nimrod being Osiris. And these Noah and his sons, antediluvians who lived these numerous years after the flood, had the divine assignment, according to this Baptist, Bilkey,